We say that the performance that you bring stands for the potential we have minus the interferences. So we all have our potential, but in many situations we're not able to access it because we're dealing with internal interferences.
You are a driven international professional or manager, have achieved quite a bit already, but are asking yourself from time to time, what do I really want? How do I want to work and live? Then this is your podcast. I'm Gina Friedrich, career and life coach for people who want to actively shape their future. Every second Thursday, I release interviews for you with inspiring, successful, as well as renowned international personalities from the world of business, NGO, and sports. They all will share with you what these questions mean to them, how they handled obstacles in their lives, and shaped their journey to where they are today. You are curious and don't want to miss anything? Visit me on gina-friedrich.com or sign up for this podcast right here. And now, let yourself be inspired on your very personal journey towards the future that you wish for. Off we go! Hello, thanks for tuning in today to the second podcast episode. My guest today is Dr. Caroline Notebaert. She's a PhD in cognitive neuroscience, and with her TEDx talk, Hack Your Own Brain, she aims to create consciousness and openness to embrace the power to unlock our talents, capacity, and skills. As a consultant and bestseller author, she tries to make cutting-edge neuroscience applicable to individuals and companies. She lives in Frankfurt and is a senior faculty member at several top business schools like the Goethe Business School or the St. Gallen Management Institute. In today's episode, Caroline tells us about her personal turning points in life and her journey to understand what it means to unlock the potential of our brain. She explains why self-regulation helps charging our mental battery and how this impacts our clear thinking, decision-making, and creativity. We will also understand why it is the best predictor for our success in personal and private life. And here she is. Hi, Caroline.
Hi, Gina.
I'm super excited to have you here today and super curious about what you're going to share with us.
Yeah, thanks a lot for inviting me. I really appreciate that.
To help our audience to get to know you a bit better, I would like to ask you, who is Caroline Notebaert?
The first thing that comes to my mind, of course, is that I am a mother with a family because this keeps me quite busy. But more in a professional direction, I am a neuroscientist. And this is not just, I don't just regard this as a profession. Being a neuroscientist for me means much more than just my profession. This is something that keeps me busy every day. So I'm absolutely fascinated to understand about how the brain works. So this is not just a profession. This is for me a real part of my identity that I carry around. And apart from that, I'm a wife. This is also an important part of my life. And if you look a bit more away from the social contacts, I do a lot of sports. So I really like running. I run a lot and I'm also a climber. And these two things are also, or have become the last few years, a very important part of my identity. Of course, I have a nationality. I'm Belgian. So many people don't really have Belgium on the map. But this is indeed also a very important part of my identity, especially because we have our own language. I speak Flemish as a first language. And I think everybody or many people would agree with me that over language, you identify yourself with that. So I'm Belgian, I'm Flemish. And I think this is in a nutshell who I am.
How did it all start? How did you get around this profession, the field of expertise you're in now?
Well, the turning point, if it comes to the profession that I have now, there are several turning points, but I think the most important one, I don't know the date anymore, but I know exactly where I was. I was studying psychology. In the first year, I had a course called neuroscience. And within that course, the first course we had, the professor was standing in front of the room and he explained to us how a brain cell was working. And I still remember that everybody in class was looking very bored. And I came out during the break and I was like, my world just opened. This is, I even have like a goosebumps just thinking of that moment, because for me at that moment, I knew I want to know everything that there is out there to know about neuroscience. Of course, I don't know everything about neuroscience, but for me, this was like a great insight because there was a perfect match between what he was telling me and about what my real interest was. So this changed my course. I still kept on studying psychology, but within psychology, I took every possible course that there was in neuroscience and behavioral neuroscience, meaning that I link neuroscience to science with behavior. And after my studies of neurosciences, I did my PhD in neurosciences, where I was also able to do some brain scans, which was extremely exciting. I had a lot of fun also doing all that with my colleagues. But then the second turning point came after my PhD. I did another few years of research and I became bored somehow because I thought, okay, there are so many great results we have, especially they're so relevant for everybody. And I've learned so much about me and my children and my family through my research. And then I decided I have a mission. I want to translate what we know about neuroscience to practice so that people who have nothing to do with neuroscience, that they understand just the basic concepts of how their brain works and how they can influence that in a positive way. So this for me was the second turning point. And ever since I'm doing that already now for about, I think, 8 to 10 years. Yeah, something like that. And this is, I really like that. I really like that because it's not just about the science. I get to read a lot. I get to still talk with my colleagues about the research, but I get to tell people about that. And I
really
enjoy that.
Really a lot of experience. And when you say like more than 8 to 10 years, that's quite a lot. So you really are an expert. Was there like, in addition to what you've just explained, one aha moment that was intense for you?
So more on the personal note then. I do also tell that to the people who, for example, a workshop where I do a talk, is where it all started for me as well, especially if it comes to the topic where I specialized, is I left my home when I was 16. So I come from a very large family. I have 4 sisters and 1 brother. And I grew up with my mother. And when I was 16, that's the moment that I decided to leave the house. And some people think this is quite hard, but for me, this was actually exactly right to do that. And I had left home. And so my mother told me, listen, whatever it is you do in your life, just realize that the nicest thing or the greatest thing that you can achieve in your life is that you can become the best version of yourself so that you can really use the potential you have, that you can really apply that so you can become the best version of yourself. This was when I was 16, so this didn't mean much to me at that moment. But it is during my time as a scientist in research when I was looking for a new topic that this came back to my mind. And that's the moment for me that I decided to focus on this one particular question. What does it mean to unlock the potential in your brain? And how do you apply that? How can we become the best versions of ourselves? This is an extremely interesting question. And we've all heard about that. But I wanted to know, how do you do that from a scientific point of view? So at that moment, when I decided to research that, this was the start of a very beautiful journey, professionally, but also personally, where I learned a lot. And it's exactly those facts that I learned on that journey that I translate into talks or workshops so people really have an access to what we know about how you unlock your potential and become the best version of yourself.
I'm just thinking, I am 16 and my mom is telling me such a nice thing to know, but yeah, without the instruction on how to actually achieve that. So it took you some time to finally find out how it works. So is there, I mean, it's probably difficult to tell that in a nutshell, but what is the answer? How do people actually get to the best of themselves?
Well, if you allow me to give a few words of explanation to that, I think I can put that in a few minutes, just the basics behind that. So it's important that the way we looked at performance is quite an alternative, or alternative, I think it's a very good way. Namely, we say that the performance that you bring stands for the potential we have minus the interferences. So we all have our potential, but in many situations, we're not able to access it because we're dealing with internal interferences. And the example that I usually give is this: you have these people who can sing very well, and then they come on stage, and all of a sudden, they're totally blocked in their potential. So you don't lose your potential, but all of a sudden, the situation creates these interferences, and you get blocked in your potential.
Mm-hmm.
So the question then is, what do you do with these internal interferences? In the end, this is the key to your best performance, if you can reduce them. And the capacity that we use to reduce those interferences is called self-regulation. So self-regulation, this is your capacity to recognize these interferences, to also effectively reduce them or regulate them so you can access your potential. And I always say to people, if there is one thing that you want to give to your employees or to your children, let it be self-regulation capacity. Let them train that. Because your potential, this is something you can take courses, you can cultivate a certain talent you have, and everybody can do that. But regulating those interferences that block you in your potential, this is of extreme importance. And science has also shown that this is the best predictor for your success on a personal level and also on a professional level. So once I realized that self-regulation plays such an important role, I started to investigate self-regulation from a neuroscientific point of view. And this for me is another time where the world opened to me, because understanding the neuroscience behind this self-regulation concept and how you can improve that, eventually this is also where the answer lies to the question, how do you unlock your potential? So this is how I got busy with the concept of self-regulation. And perhaps I can just say a few words on the neuroscience behind that, if that's okay.
Sure, but may I ask just one quick question? How do you define potential?
Potential, the way we looked at it, is your skills, your talents, your expertise, your experiences, everything you've learned. So this is really, it's all your strengths, whether they're a talent or whether this is something that you just trained without necessarily being a talent. So these are all your strengths defined in a very broad way.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. And on top of that, perhaps this is also, it's good that you ask, because this is also the thing that we like to do. It's important to distinguish between things that we can do very well and we like to do, and the things we can do very well but we don't like to do. So I think we all know these skills we have, and we know we're good at them, but we don't like to use them.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of people are actually, they might even be working in a field where there's a skill set needed they're good at, but it's not actually what they would love to do.
Exactly. And this is a situation, for example, that can lead to the fact that even though you have the potential to do something, you are actually fighting all the time with internal interferences because you don't like to do it. And then you will also not bring your best performance.
I think this is very important to know and be aware of. So now I'm excited to hear what you wanted to explain now in addition to what you started with.
Yeah. So these internal interferences that block us in our potential, most of them, they're being caused by too much activation in one particular brain region, and we call that the amygdala. They're very small structures, very deep inside the brain, and they're very quickly active. And we need those amygdala just to, you know, process the world, to make decisions, to create emotions. We need them. But if they're too active in a situation where there's no danger, they will cause internal interferences. And the typical way we experience that is feelings of stress, feelings of insecurity, feelings of anxiety. They're all different feelings that block us in our potential, but eventually they're all being caused by too much activation in your amygdala area. So this is one part. But on the other side, what it is that we need for our potential is we need a totally different brain structure. We need a brain structure that is fully in front of the brain. And evolutionary spoken, this is one of the newest brain structures that we have. And this prefrontal cortex, fully in front of the brain, plays a significant role in all your executive functions, such as planning, organizing, processing information, making decisions, making good decisions, good quality decisions, analyzing figures, analyzing charts. So I would say that many people, especially those people who have an office job or people who are in a leadership position, pretty much every task that they complete, they require their prefrontal cortex for that. Now, as many people have already experienced, the prefrontal cortex has a limited capacity. You have to imagine that it looks a bit like a mental battery. So if your mental battery is fully charged, you will extremely quickly and at a very high quality analyze information and make good decisions. But if your battery is empty, you will be the worst version of yourselves. And you will not actually make any good decisions, and you will not be capable to think clearly anymore. So if you look at a regular day, you can see that we use our prefrontal cortex for pretty much everything we do. Even just if I look at my own life, I have two children, they're a bit older now. but when they were very young, before I arrived at work, I had already dealt with two girls who did not want to wear what I wanted them to wear. They did not want to eat their food. They did not want to get into the car, and they did not want to put on their shoes. So these kind of events, they already required a lot of my prefrontal cortex. So I arrived in work and my mental battery was pretty much empty, or in best cases, it was half full. So you see that everything that happens throughout the day, especially we live in a world where the complexity is enormous. The insecurity, especially connected to our job, is enormous. And these are typical factors that lead to, or that are a large burden of your prefrontal cortex. And in situations like that, the prefrontal cortex gets empty quickly and your amygdala is getting more and more free play. So if you had a very, very busy day and you come home and everybody in the house is running around with an empty mental battery and the amygdala is firing, this is the moment people start fighting, right? And that's the moment that is another turning point, then more from the theoretical part as well, where I thought, I don't want to live like that. I don't want to come home, especially the moment where I have time for me and my family and with my children, being in this mental state where I have too much amygdala activation and an empty battery. So we need a solution for that. So that's the moment that I also started to look for a solution. And then I will also come to the end of my nutshell story of how you can improve your self-regulation. But I started to ask myself the question, how can we down-regulate this amygdala activation effectively and at the same time give a boost to the prefrontal cortex? Eventually, these are the ingredients for unlocking your potential, because you will reduce your interferences because the amygdala is causing them. And you will also boost your prefrontal cortex, meaning your potential will be boosted as well. This is the perfect solution to unlock your potential and become the best version of yourself. And I've looked around for many strategies, and there is many strategies out there, but there is actually one strategy that does exactly that. And it's this strategy that when you regularly practice that, you will actually see two main effects. There are many, many scientific studies that back that up with detailed studies. First of all, you can see that the prefrontal cortex, along with its executive functions, gets a significant boost. That means that if we practice regularly, what will we see? We will see that all these functions running over the prefrontal cortex will significantly improve, such as creativity, decision making, everything that has to do with cognitive performance, that will all significantly improve. The second line of findings is related to the fact that if we regularly practice this strategy, you will see that the amygdala becomes much less activated. It even reduces in size. So this means that the largest source of your internal interferences that blocks you in your potential, these become smaller. And even just this effect on its own has a lot of positive advantages, because many of the problems we experience at home and in work, most of them are caused by too much amygdala activation. So if the amygdala comes down in activation and intensity of how it activates, you see that many problems will just solve themselves, or they will spontaneously improve. And now the strategy I'm talking about here is called mindfulness. Mindfulness meditation, we also say. Now, I must say that as a scientist, I was extremely skeptical. So the first time that I read the word mindfulness meditation, I was having weird associations in my mind, thinking this has all to do with burning essences or, you know, even putting candles in your ears. This is always a joke I make because that's the image I had in my mind. But mindfulness meditation, and I really can assure you that, is nothing esoteric. It is a scientifically underbuilt method to downregulate your amygdala activation effectively and positively boost your own potential. And of course, as a scientist, I read everything I could read about that, and I started to even include that in the research that we did at the time. But of course, I never practiced it. You know, at that time, you know, I was thinking, now I know that, but I'm not going to practice it because I was still very skeptical. But of course, I think also about 8 years ago or something, I decided to start also practice that. And it really was a life changer for me. It really was a life changer. And especially because I think we all know what it's like to have a very busy life, to take on a lot of assignments and to wanting a lot. I mean, we want to have a career, we want to have 5 children, we want to have 2 dogs, and we all want to run a marathon, right? So how are you going to do that?
I don't. I mean, the marathon thing, at least.
That's good. So, I mean, it's crazy how many people live, yeah? And this is absolutely not possible.
Yeah, no one is questioning that, right? Everyone thinks that's the way it is, and they have to survive, and they have to go from one day to the next. So it's, yeah, I'm impressed about the findings and the kind of easy solution you might have for that, that everyone might even be able to practice on their own to make a difference in their own life.
It is, and this is the beauty of mindfulness meditation. Now, I must say, for those people who are not at home in the field of mindfulness meditation, there is many, many types of meditations. And when I say mindfulness meditation, I don't mean just any type of meditation. I very, very specifically mean mindfulness meditation. And there is only one correct way of how to practice mindfulness meditation. And it's important that if you would decide to include mindfulness meditation into your daily life, that you do this correctly. Because I think there is many people out there who say that they teach mindfulness meditation, and unfortunately I've met quite a few, and if you really look closely at what they do, it has nothing to do with mindfulness meditation. It definitely is one type of meditation, but if you want to do the mindfulness meditation, just make sure you really go for the pure mindfulness meditation.
Do you have a recommendation where people can find out more about mindfulness meditation? Maybe there's a book you could recommend, or maybe it's even in one of your books.
Yeah, I do have a book, but this is in German, and this is only purely mindfulness meditation. And this is called Wie das Gehirn eine Spitzenleistung bringt, which is published by the FAZ. So there we have the science combined also with the practice. But if you would go, for example, to John Kabat-Zinn, I think many people, if you just Google him, you will find many good practices. He's also just a pure mindfulness guy. So with mindfulness, it always has to do with, we have a very busy mind. It's like people call it the monkey in the mind. We can also measure this network in the brain. It's the monkey mind, so to say, and it's very busy. And the monkey mind, or these busy thoughts, they lead to our emotions, also our amygdala activation. What you do with mindfulness meditation is you bring your full attention to just feeling your senses. So that's feeling, tasting, you know, you can feel your hands, you can feel your breathing, you can feel your feet, you can do a type of body scan. And if you bring your attention to your senses, biologically what will happen in the brain is that you will deactivate the network that is producing your thoughts. So the monkey mind will actually become quiet. And of course, it's the monkey mind that leads to the amygdala activation. So if with mindfulness practice, you always get into the awareness of your senses, you will deactivate the monkey mind. And as a consequence, the amygdala will quiet down. And if you regularly practice it, let's say you do this week 3 to 5 minutes, then you increase perhaps to 5 to 10 or to 15 minutes at some point. If you regularly practice, you will also see that the amygdala quietens down when you're not practicing.
Wow.
And this is, I think, where the power of mindfulness meditation lies, that these events that used to lead to a lot of amygdala activation in the past, after regular mindfulness practice, even 3 to 4 weeks, you start feeling a lot of benefits, even the moments you're not practicing.
That's interesting, because, I mean, I do yoga, not as much as I should do recently, but and at the end there's this shavasana where you really then just lay down and you do this body scan. But I really thought that it's like the moment I do it, it helps me. I didn't really think about the consequences on a longer term for everything that happens in my brain. So that's very interesting. Is there a special time when it's best to do it? Like when I'm really stressed, should I then make a little break and do mindfulness meditation? Or would you say it doesn't matter when you do it, as long as you do it?
Indeed. So first of all, it doesn't matter when you do it, as long as you do it. This means that if you would prefer to practice in the evening time rather than the morning, or whenever you want to practice, this will all be effective. As long as you do practice it correctly, it's all effective. Doesn't matter when you do it. And at some point, you will just see that the amygdala will quiet down, also when you don't practice. It doesn't mean, of course, that you will not get stressed anymore. You will definitely at certain moments still feel stressed. And of course, once you're getting used to the mindfulness practice, you can also easily adapt that in situations that you experience as very stressful. This is something that I would not recommend to do that straight away. So some people think after listening to the science behind it, they're like, okay, so if I have a talk tomorrow with my boss and everything is going very badly, I will just close my eyes and get into contact with my senses. This is not going to help. So at some point, you will be able to practice that in the moment where it's difficult, also when you are stressed or even in interaction with other people. But it's good to, first of all, get the regular practice and then start introducing that in certain situations that might make it easier.
How would you, or where would you see a valuable link between what you just described, the experiences and expertise you have in that field, in regards to the possibility of shaping one's own future?
You know, what mindfulness does, it actually sets you free mentally. That's how I see it. So this increases our freedom to decide. So if we're very stressed and if we are having a lot of interferences, internal interferences in our mind, usually we're just going in one particular direction. But if you can reduce those internal interferences and you set free your potential, then of course it's up to you to decide in which direction you'd like to steer your potential. And that's still an additional question you have to ask yourself. So I see that some people who I work with in certain companies, due to mindfulness practice, it comes also with an increased awareness. So if you practice mindfulness regularly, you will become much more also aware of the thoughts you have, the stress level you have, you become just much more aware of that. This also might lead to decisions where you say, actually, I've not been in the right place for the last few years. And this awareness on its own is very important, because then you can choose a new direction. But on top of that, mindfulness also helps you to actually build the courage to make the change. And this is what I have seen happening with quite a few people who started to practice mindfulness.
This really is super interesting, especially with all the scientific background you just gave us in order to understand this a bit better. How did this impact your own life?
Yeah, I would not say it's a black and white difference, but it's a large difference. I think especially if it comes to my family. So I think in work, also because I was a researcher before I started to practice and I was working a lot of my own, I don't think I had a lot of collisions in work. But if it comes to more the interaction with myself and the interaction especially with my children, this really changed a lot. That was really a large change, especially I still have to think of the example that my child gave me 2 weeks ago. She said, you know, Mama, you're never in a bad mood. You always take the time to talk with me. And I think that's the right way of doing it.
How nice.
And I was like, wow. I was like, I'm in a bad mood so many times. Perhaps you just don't notice it. Yeah, but this actually made me think of, I was not like that 8 years ago. I was not like that. And my two children, they came very close after one another. And my second baby, she was a cry baby. So I was really exhausted most of the time. And these are moments that we lose control. These are moments that you're not capable of listening anymore, or just, you know, patiently deal with situations. But this is something that really changed. It really changed a lot, especially just being more patient, not straight away wanting to react in a situation, but just, you know, observing the situation before acting something. And especially how it helped me, if it comes to my life vision, is that in the past, I worried a lot about financial security. You know, this is something like, oh, I have to make sure that I earn enough money so I can buy a house and I can. And this is something with mindfulness that helped me to reduce my fear for these type of possible situations and much more just enjoy the moment as it comes. And this is, I believe, where happiness lies. It's so easy that people tell you all the time, oh, just be in the moment. And you're like, what? How can I be in the moment? You know, I have like my job to do, I have my kids to take care of, so, and you want me to be in the moment? And I get that reaction. But it's because we practice mindfulness that those negative thoughts we have and the connected emotions, that they really cool down. So this creates, in German, there is this very beautiful word for it. It's called Gelassenheit. And many people really want more Gelassenheit, but they have no clue how to do it. It's not because you know that you want that you know how to do it. Just a feeling of having this open mind and not, you know, getting stuck in negative thoughts, this definitely improves. And this is just, it's a life changer that changes the quality of your life.
And Caroline, with all the insights and learnings from the past years, what's the one question you wish you had asked yourself or mentor earlier in life?
What's important in life? Definitely. I'm not sure if I would have wanted to ask it somebody else, but I definitely would have asked myself that much earlier on, what really matters in life? And I think if you ask yourself that question, what really matters to me in my life, what really contributes to my happiness, you know, to the feeling of happiness? If you ask yourself that question, I think there's many things that you can actually strike from your list straight away that does not lead you to your happiness, and that eventually takes up a lot of time. So I think this is something I wished I would have asked myself earlier on.
You probably now have found the answer to that. So looking at today's life, what's non-negotiable for you in your professional and work life?
That I would work in a fixed structure. I'm not sure if this is the best way of putting that, but just every day getting up and taking my car or taking the public transport, go to an office and sit in my office, and then in the evening time come back exhausted. Never, ever, ever will I do that again in my life. Never, ever.
Yeah, I'm self-employed myself now for the very first time in my life. I have to admit that I was not aware of the many positive changes coming with it. But this always depends on the actual profession and field someone is working in and what the setting is that you need for work. The good thing is that there is much improvement in regards to flexible work with home office, for example.
Indeed, you're definitely right. This is changing. And also on top of that, I'd like to say that some people actually really do enjoy going to work and have this fixed structure. So it depends probably also a bit on your personality, but as you have experienced yourself, being able to break free from that very fixed structure does not mean that you don't work. I mean, I probably work more than just a normal 9-to-5 job, but I do it in my own time, and I can flexibly decide on my working hours. And this, I think, has contributed a lot to my quality of life.
You have your own company. There are all the good things coming with it, but of course there are also some uncertainties and risks sometimes you take. What drives you and motivates you to keep going when it's getting a bit tough?
It is my passion. I am absolutely passionate about the neurosciences and telling people about it. I mean, and now the story that I've told you today, I think I've told this now for I don't know how many times. I've been telling it the last 8 years, so you can already guess how many times I've told you. But every time when I say it, I feel I believe it. And I just really feel that it's such an important message to give. So I have this mission that I can share with other people. And I just want to give them that information. And then it's up to them to decide, do I want to do something with that or not? That's definitely not up to me. But just for me, that there is a possibility out there to share that with other people, this absolutely keeps me going. Because I really believe, from a scientific but also a personal point of view, that this is something we need. This mindfulness is, I think, the only strategy that is going to help us to deal with the challenges we are facing. And that keeps me going.
What would you recommend a person, like, let's say, a close friend who's trying to find his passion in life, maybe not even having a clue yet?
There is this these two questions that I sometimes use in my workshop. And one is, you know, let's say that you're at the end of your life at right now and you look back, what would you have wanted to do more of, you know? So, and then you never hear somebody say, I want to do something more in work or, you know, whatever. It's always, this always has to do straightly with your identity and what it is that you really want in life. So this is one way of looking at that. Then the second one is also a question that you ask people, what is on your bucket list? So what are the things you really want to do in your life? Let's say that money doesn't matter, time doesn't matter, and you just can do anything what it is you want. What are the things that are on your list? And you see that when people talk about that, very, very quickly, they get into connection with what it is they really want to do. And sure, there's people who say, I want to do a certain trip, or I want to do a certain hobby that I can spend more time with. And sure, they cannot just straight away give up their job and just do their hobby. But the point is, we so often forget what it is we really like to do. And once in a while, we need a reminder and then really just make that a part of our life. Perhaps not give up our profession, but at least actively be busy with that. Because life can end tomorrow. And then, you know, you would have so much regretted looking back, you know, that you haven't done that.
Thanks so much for sharing all this, Caroline. I think it's super valuable for many, many people. And even for those who might think there is no way to change that, or that's how life works. Or I think it's super important to just try it and see what happens. And that's also something that I always do, like try it out, see for yourself if it works for you or not. For some people it might not work. I would, for example, never think that my mom could do it. Mom, if you're listening, I'm sorry that I officially stated that now, but I think it's definitely worth trying, because it might make a super big difference. Caroline, thanks a lot. I will put all the links into the show notes. I wish you all the best, and I hope you're going to continue spreading the word.
Yeah, thank you so much, Tina, for this invitation. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Speak to you soon. You want to know more about Liverpool's coach Jürgen Klopp and his personal journey? Here is a little sneak peek of the next English episode.
And then when I did what I did, then I realized pretty early that I want to be a football coach and manager. And it was based on a dream I had from time to time that people realize. When I slept, and I had a real dream. When I slept and I realized, in the dream, people told me, You can't not play football at all. Yes, I know. But my answer is, I know. But I love it too much to stop doing it. And so it was, if somebody would ask me at 25, look, you cannot play football, but you can be the coach of that team, what do you think? I would have said immediately, yes.
Don't want to miss out on this? Sign up for this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Deezer, Spotify or Android Podcasts. Or visit me on gina-friedrich.com/podcast. Thanks for your time today.